decidedly different view of things. Indeed, some of the department's most senior officers harbored an outright dislike of Jews. One of these was William Phillips, Undersecretary of State, the second highest-ranking man in the department after Secretary Hull. Phillips's wife and Eleanor Roosevelt were childhood friends. It was FDR, not Hull, who had chosen Phillips to be Undersecretary. In his diary, Phillips described a business acquaintance as "my little Jewish friend from Boston." Phillips loved visiting Atlantic City, but in another diary entry he wrote, "The place is infested with Jews. In fact, the whole beach scene on Saturday afternoon and Sunday was an extraordinary sight. Very little sand to be seen, the whole beach covered by slightly clothed Jews and Jewesses." Another key official, Wilbur J. Carr, an assistant secretary of state who had overall charge of the consular service, called Jews kikes. In a memorandum on Russian and Polish immigrants, he wrote, "They are filthy, un-American, and often dangerous in their habits." After a trip to Detroit, he described the city as being full of dust, smoke, dirt, Jews. He too complained of the Jewish presence in Atlantic City. He and his wife spent 3 days there one February, and for each of the days he made an entry in his diary that disparaged Jews. "In all our day's journey along the boardwalk, we saw but few Gentiles," he wrote on the first day, "Jews everywhere, and of the commonest kind." He and his wife dined that night in the Claridge Hotel and found its dining room full of Jews, and few presented a good appearance. "Only two others beside myself in dinner jacket. Very careless atmosphere in dining room." The next night the Carrs went to dinner at a different hotel, the Marlborough Blenheim, and found it far more refined. "I like it," Carr wrote. "How different from the Jewish atmosphere of the Claridge." An official of the American Jewish Committee described Carr as "an anti-Semite and a trickster, who talks beautifully and contrives to do nothing for us." Both Carr and Phillips favored strict adherence to a provision in the nation's immigration laws that barred entry to all would-be immigrants considered likely to become a public charge, the notorious LPC clause. A component of the Immigration Act of 1917, it had been reinstated by the Hoover administration in 1930 to discourage immigration at a time when unemployment was soaring. Consular officials possessed great power over who got to come to America because they were the ones who decided which visa applicants could be excluded under the LPC clause. Immigration law also required that applicants provide a police affidavit attesting to their good character, along with duplicate copies of birth certificates and other government records. "It seems quite preposterous," one Jewish memoirist wrote, "to have to go to your enemy and ask for a character reference." Jewish activists charged that America's consulates abroad had been instructed quietly to grant only a fraction of the visas allowed for each country, a charge that proved to have merit. The Labor Department's own solicitor, Charles E. Wazanski, discovered in 1933 that consuls had been given informal oral instructions to limit the number of immigration visas they approved to 10% of the total allowed by each nation's quota. Jewish leaders contended further that the act of acquiring police records had become not merely difficult, but dangerous, an almost insuperable obstacle, as Judge Proskauer stated in a letter to Undersecretary Phillips. Phillips took offense at Proskauer's depiction of consuls as obstacles. "The consul," Phillips replied, gently chiding, "is only concerned with determining in a helpful and considerate manner whether applicants for visas have met the requirements of law." One result, according to Proskauer and other Jewish leaders, was that Jews simply did not apply for immigration to the United States. Indeed, the number of Germans who applied for visas was a tiny fraction of the 26,000 allowed under the annual quota set for the country. This disparity gave officials within the State Department a powerful statistical argument for opposing reform. How could there be a problem if so few Jews applied in the first place? It was an argument that Roosevelt, as early as April 1933, appeared to accept. He also knew that any effort to liberalize immigration rules might well prompt Congress to respond with drastic reductions of existing quotas. By the time of his lunch with Dodd, Roosevelt was acutely aware of the sensitivities at play. "The German authorities are treating the Jews shamefully, and the Jews in this country are greatly excited," Roosevelt told him. "But this is also not a governmental affair. We can do nothing except for American citizens who happen to be made victims. We must protect them, and whatever we can do to moderate the general persecution by unofficial and personal influence ought to be done." The conversation turned to practicalities. Dodd insisted he would live within his designated salary of $17,500, a lot of money during the Depression, but a skimpy sum for an ambassador who would have to entertain European diplomats and Nazi officials. It was a point of principle for Dodd. He did not think an ambassador should live extravagantly while the rest of the nation suffered. For him, however, it also happened to be a moot point, since he lacked the independent wealth that so many other ambassadors possessed and thus could not have lived extravagantly even if he had wanted to. "You are quite right," Roosevelt told him. "Aside from two or three general dinners and entertainments, you need not indulge in any expensive social affairs. Try to give fair attention to Americans in Berlin and occasional dinners to Germans who are interested in American relations. I think you can manage to live within your income and not sacrifice any essential parts of the service." After some additional conversation about trade tariffs and arms reductions, the lunch came to an end. It was 2 o'clock. Dodd left the White House and walked to the State Department, where he planned to meet with various officials and to read dispatches filed from Berlin, namely the lengthy reports written by Consul General George S. Messerschmitt. The reports were disconcerting. Hitler had been chancellor for 6 months, having received the appointment through a political deal, but he did not yet possess absolute power. Germany's 85-year-old president, Field Marshal Paul von Benkendorff und von Hindenburg, still held the constitutional authority to appoint and remove chancellors and their cabinets, and equally important, commanded the loyalty of the regular army, the Reichswehr. By contrast to Hindenburg, Hitler and his deputies were surprisingly young, Hitler only 44, Hermann Göring 40, and Joseph Goebbels 36. It was one thing to read newspaper stories about Hitler's erratic behavior and his government's brutality toward Jews, communists, and other opponents, for throughout America there was a widely held belief that such reports must be exaggerated, that surely no modern state could behave in such a manner. Here at the State Department, however, Dodd read dispatch after dispatch in which Messerschmitt described Germany's rapid descent from democratic republic to brutal dictatorship. Messerschmitt spared no detail. His tendency to write long had early on saddled him with the nickname 40-Page George. He wrote of the widespread violence that had occurred in the several months that immediately followed Hitler's appointment, and of the increasing control the government exerted over all aspects of German society. On March 31st, three U.S. citizens had been kidnapped and dragged to one of the stormtroopers' beating stations, where they had been stripped of their clothing and left to spend the night in the cold. Come morning, they had been beaten until they lost consciousness, then discarded on the street. A correspondent for United Press International had disappeared, but after inquiries by Messerschmitt had been released unharmed. Hitler's government had declared a one-day boycott of all Jewish businesses in Germany, stores, law firms, doctors' offices, and there were the book burnings, the firings of Jews from businesses, the seemingly endless marches of stormtroopers, and the suppression of Germany's once vibrant free press, which, according to Messerschmitt, had been placed under government control to a degree greater than has probably ever existed in any country. The press censorship may be considered an absolute. In one of his latest dispatches, however, Messerschmitt took a markedly more positive tone, which Dodd doubtless found heartening. With uncharacteristic optimism, Messerschmitt now reported seeing signs that Germany was growing more stable, and attributed this to the growing confidence of Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels. "Responsibility has already changed the primary leaders of the party very considerably," he wrote. "There is every evidence that they are becoming constantly more moderate." Dodd, however, never got the chance to read a letter that Messerschmitt wrote soon afterward, in which he retracted this cheerier assessment. Marked personal and confidential, he sent it to Undersecretary Phillips. The letter, dated June 26, 1933, reached Phillips just as the Dodds were about to leave for Berlin. "I have tried to point out in my dispatches that the higher leaders of the party are growing more moderate, while the intermediary leaders and the masses are just as radical as ever, and that the question is whether the higher leaders will be able to impose their moderate will on the masses," Messerschmitt wrote. "It begins to look pretty definitely that they will not be able to do so, but that the pressure from the bottom is becoming stronger all the time. Goering and Goebbels in particular no longer seemed so moderate," he wrote. "Dr. Goebbels is daily preaching that the revolution has just begun, and what has so far been done is just an overture." Priests were being arrested. A former president of Lower Silesia, whom Messerschmitt knew personally, had been placed in a concentration camp. He sensed a rising hysteria among mid-level leaders of the Nazi Party, expressed as a belief that the only safety lies in getting everybody in jail. The nation was quietly but aggressively readying itself for war, deploying propaganda to conjure the perception that the whole world is against Germany, and that it lies defenseless before the world. Hitler's vows of peaceful intent were illusory, meant only to buy time for Germany to rearm, Messerschmitt warned. What they most want to do, however, definitely is to make Germany the most capable instrument of war that there has ever existed. While in Washington, Dodd attended a reception thrown for him by the German embassy, and there he met Wilbur Carr for the first time. Later, Carr jotted a quick description of Dodd in his diary. "Pleasing, interesting person, with fine sense of humor and simple modesty." Dodd also paid a call on the State Department's chief of Western European Affairs, J. Pierpont Moffat, who shared Carr's and Phillips's distaste for Jews, as well as their hardline attitude toward immigration. Moffat recorded his own impression of the new ambassador. "He is extremely sure of his opinion, expresses himself forcibly and didactically, and tends to dramatize the points he makes. The only fly in the ointment is that he is going to try and run the embassy with a family of four persons on his salary, and how he is going to do it in Berlin, where prices are high, is something beyond me." What neither Carr nor Moffat expressed in these entries was the surprise and displeasure they and many of their peers had felt at Dodd's appointment. Theirs was an elite realm, to which only men of a certain pedigree could expect ready admission. Many had gone to the same prep schools, mainly St. Paul's and Groton, and from there to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. Undersecretary Phillips grew up in Boston's Back Bay neighborhood, in a giant Victorian pile of a house. He was independently wealthy from the age of 21, and later in life became a regent of Harvard College. Most of his peers in the State Department also had money, and while abroad spent heavily from their own funds with no expectation of reimbursement. One such official, Hugh Wilson, in praise of his fellow diplomats, wrote, "They have all felt that they belonged to a pretty good club. That feeling has fostered a healthy esprit de corps." By the club's standards, Dodd was about as poor a fit as could be imagined. He returned to Chicago to pack and attend various goodbye functions, after which he and his wife and Martha and Bill all set out by train for Virginia and a last stay at the Round Hill Farm. His 86-year-old father, John, lived relatively near in North Carolina, but Dodd, despite his wish that his own children remain close at hand, did not at first plan to visit him, given that Roosevelt wanted his new ambassador in Berlin as soon as possible. Dodd had written to his father to tell him of his appointment and that he would not have a chance to visit before his departure. He enclosed a little money and wrote, "I am sorry to be so far away all my life." His father immediately replied how proud he was that Dodd had received this great honor from D.C., but added that tincture of vinegar that only parents seem to know how to apply, that little something that causes guilt to flare and plans to change. The elder Dodd wrote, "If I never see you any more while I live, it will be all right. I shall be proud of you to the last hours I live." Dodd changed his plans. On July 1st, a Saturday, he and his wife boarded a sleeper car bound for North Carolina. During their visit with Dodd's father, they made time for a tour of local landmarks. Dodd and his wife touched old ground, as if saying goodbye for the last time. They visited the family cemetery, where Dodd stood before the grave of his mother, who had died in 1909. As he walked the grass, he came upon the plots of ancestors caught up in the Civil War, including two who surrendered with General Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. It was a visit filled with reminders of family misfortune and the precariousness of life. "A rather sorrowful day," he wrote. He and his wife returned to Virginia and the farm, then proceeded by train to New York. Martha and Bill drove the family Chevrolet, intending to drop it off at the wharf for transit to Berlin. Dodd would have preferred to spend the next couple of days with his family, but the department had insisted that once he got to New York, he attend a number of meetings with bank executives on the issue of Germany's debt, a subject in which Dodd had little interest, and with Jewish leaders. Dodd feared that both the American and German press could twist these meetings to taint the appearance of objectivity that he hoped to present in Berlin. He complied, however, and the result was a day of encounters that evoked the serial visits of ghosts in Dickens's A Christmas Carol. A letter from a prominent Jewish relief activist told Dodd that he would be visited on the night of Monday, July 3rd, by two groups of men, the first to arrive by 8:30, the second at 9 o'clock. The meetings were to take place at the Century Club, Dodd's base, while in New York. First, however, Dodd met the bankers, and did so at the offices of the National City Bank of New York, which years later would be called Citibank. Dodd was startled to learn that National City Bank and Chase National Bank held over $100 million in German bonds, which Germany at this point was proposing to pay back at a rate of 30 cents on the dollar. "There was much talk, but no agreement, other than that I should do all I possibly could to prevent Germany's defaulting openly," Dodd wrote. He had little sympathy for the bankers. The prospect of high interest rates on German bonds had blinded them to the all-too-obvious risk that a war-crushed, politically volatile country might default. That evening, the Jewish leaders arrived as scheduled, among them Felix M. Warburg, a leading financier who tended to favor the quieter tactics of the American Jewish Committee, and Rabbi Wise of the noisier American Jewish Congress. Dodd wrote in his diary, "For an hour and a half, the discussion went on. The Germans are killing Jews all the time. They are being persecuted to the point where suicide is common. The Warburg family is reported to have had cases of this kind, and all Jewish property is being confiscated." During this meeting, Warburg appears to have mentioned the suicide of two elderly relatives, Moritz and Katje Oppenheim, in Frankfurt some 3 weeks earlier. Warburg wrote later, "No doubt the Hitler regime made life for them a plague, and they were yearning for the end of their days." Dodd's visitors urged him to press Roosevelt for official intervention, but he demurred. "I insisted that the government could not intervene officially, but assured the members of the conference that I would exert all possible personal influence against unjust treatment of German Jews, and of course protest against maltreatment of American Jews." Afterward, Dodd caught an 11 p.m. train to Boston, and upon his arrival early the next morning, July 4th, was driven by chauffeured car to the home of Colonel Edward M. House, a friend who was a close advisor to Roosevelt, for a meeting over breakfast. In the course of a wide-ranging conversation, Dodd learned for the first time how far he had been from being Roosevelt's first choice. The news was humbling. Dodd noted in his diary that it tamped any inclination on his part to be over-egotistical about his appointment. When the conversation turned to Germany's persecution of Jews, Colonel House urged Dodd to do all he could to ameliorate Jewish sufferings, but added a caveat. The Jews should not be allowed to dominate economic or intellectual life in Berlin, as they have done for a long time. In this, Colonel House expressed a sentiment pervasive in America, that Germany's Jews were at least partly responsible for their own troubles. Dodd encountered a more rabid form of it later that same day after returning to New York, when he and his family went to dinner at the Park Avenue apartment of Charles R. Crane, 75, a philanthropist whose family had grown wealthy selling plumbing supplies. Crane was an Arabist, said to be influential in certain Middle Eastern and Balkan nations, and was a generous supporter of Dodd's department at the University of Chicago, where he had endowed a chair for the study of Russian history and institutions. Dodd already knew that Crane was no friend of Jews. When Crane earlier had written to congratulate Dodd on his appointment, he had offered some advice. The Jews, after winning the war, galloping along at a swift pace, getting Russia, England, and Palestine, being caught in the act of trying to seize Germany, too, and meeting their first real rebuff, have gone plumb crazy and are deluging the world, particularly easy America, with anti-German propaganda. I strongly advise you to resist every social invitation. Dodd partly embraced Crane's notion that the Jews shared responsibility for their plight. He wrote to Crane later, after arriving in Berlin, that while he did not approve of the ruthlessness that is being applied to the Jews here, he did think the Germans had a valid grievance. When I have occasion to speak unofficially to eminent Germans, I have said very frankly that they had a very serious problem, but that they did not seem to know how to solve it. He wrote, "The Jews had held a great many more of the key positions in Germany than their numbers or their talents entitled them to." Over dinner, Dodd heard Crane express great admiration for Hitler, and learned as well that Crane himself had no objection to how the Nazis were treating Germany's Jews. As the Dodds left that evening, Crane gave the ambassador one more bit of advice. "Let Hitler have his way." At 11 o'clock the next morning, July 5, 1933, the Dodds took a taxi to the wharf and boarded their ship, the Washington, bound for Hamburg. They ran into Eleanor Roosevelt just after she had bid bon voyage to son Franklin Jr., who was sailing to Europe to begin a sojourn abroad. A dozen or so reporters also swarmed aboard and cornered Dodd on deck as he stood with his wife and Bill. At that moment, Martha was elsewhere on the ship. The reporters threw out questions and prodded the Dodds to pose, as if waving goodbye. With reluctance, they did so, Dodd wrote, and unaware of the similarity of the Hitler salute, then unknown to us, we raised our hands. The resulting photographs caused a minor outcry, where they seemed to capture Dodd, his wife, and son in mid-heil. Dodd's misgivings flared. By this point, he had begun to dread leaving Chicago and his old life. As the ship eased from its moorage, the family experienced what Martha described later as a disproportionate amount of sadness and foreboding. Martha wept. Chapter 5 First Night. Martha continued to cry off and on for the better part of the next 2 days, copiously and sentimentally, as she put it. Not out of anxiety, for she had given little thought to what life in Hitler's Germany might really be like. Rather, she wept for all she was leaving behind, the people and places, her friends and job, the familiar comfort of the house on Blackstone Avenue, her lovely Carl, all of which composed the inestimably precious life she had led in Chicago. If she needed a reminder of what she stood to lose, the seating at her going-away party provided it. She sat between Sandberg and another close friend, Thornton Wilder. Gradually her sorrow eased. The seas were calm, the days bright. She and Roosevelt's son chummed around and danced and drank champagne. They examined each other's passports, his identifying him succinctly as son of the President of the United States, hers a tad more pretentious, daughter of William E. Dodd, Ambassador Extraordinary and Plenipotentiary of the United States to Germany. Her father required that she and her brother come to his stateroom, number A-10, for at least an hour a day and listen to him read aloud in German, so that they would gain a sense of how the language sounded. He seemed unusually solemn, and Martha sensed an unaccustomed nervousness. For her, however, the prospect of the adventure ahead soon pushed aside her anxiety. She knew little of international politics, and by her own admission did not appreciate the gravity of what was occurring in Germany. She saw Hitler as a clown who looked like Charlie Chaplin. Like many others in America at this time and elsewhere in the world, she could not imagine him lasting very long or being taken seriously. She was ambivalent about the Jewish situation. As a student at the University of Chicago, she had experienced a subtle and undercurrent propaganda among the undergraduates that promulgated hostility toward Jews. Martha found that even many of the college professors resented the brilliance of Jewish colleagues and students. As for herself, I was slightly anti-Semitic in this sense. I accepted the attitude that Jews were not as physically attractive as Gentiles, and were less socially desirable. She also found herself absorbing a view that Jews, while generally brilliant, were rich and pushy. In this, she reflected the attitude of a surprising proportion of other Americans, as captured in the 1930s by practitioners of the then-emerging art of public opinion polling. One poll found that 41% of those contacted believed Jews had too much power in the United States. Another found that one-fifth wanted to drive Jews out of the United States. A poll taken decades in the future, in 2009, would find that the total of Americans who believed Jews had too much power had shrunk to 13%. A classmate described Martha as Scarlett O'Hara and an enchantress, luscious and blonde, with luminous blue eyes and pale, translucent skin. She considered herself a writer, and hoped eventually to make a career of writing short stories and novels. Sandberg urged her forward. "The personality is all there in you," he wrote. "Time, solitude, toil are the main old-time simple requisites for you. You've got just about everything else for the doing of whatever you want to do as a writer." Shortly after the family's departure for Berlin, Sandberg instructed her to keep notes on everything and anything, and to give way to every beckoning to write short things, impressions, sudden lyric sentences you have a gift for outpouring. "Above all," he urged, "find out what this man Hitler is made of, what makes his brain go round, what his bones and blood are made of." Thornton Wilder also offered some parting advice. He warned Martha to avoid writing for newspapers, because such hack work would destroy the concentration she would need for serious writing. He did recommend that she keep a diary of what things looked like, the rumors and opinions of people during a political time. "In the future," he wrote, "such a diary would be of liveliest interest to you and, oh my God, to me." Some of Martha's friends believed she was romantically involved with him as well, though in fact his affinities lay elsewhere. Martha kept a picture of him in a locket. On Dodd's second day at sea, as he strolled the deck of the Washington, he spotted a familiar face, Rabbi Wise, one of the Jewish leaders he had met in New York 3 days earlier. Over the week's voyage that followed, they spoke together about Germany half a dozen or more times. Wise reported to a fellow Jewish leader, Julian W. Mack, a federal appellate judge, he was most friendly and cordial, and indeed confidential. Dodd, true to character, spoke at length about American history, and at one point told Rabbi Wise, One cannot write the whole truth about Jefferson and Washington. People are not ready and must be prepared for it. This startled Wise, who called it the only disturbing note of the week. He explained, if people must be prepared for the truth about Jefferson and Washington, what will Dodd do with the truth when he learns it about Hitler in view of his official post? Wise continued, whenever I suggested that the greatest service he could render his own country and Germany would be to tell the truth to the Chancellor, to make clear to him how public opinion, including Christian opinion and political opinion, had turned against Germany, he answered again and again, I cannot tell until I talk to Hitler. If I find I can do so, I will talk very frankly to him and tell him everything. Their many talks aboard ship drew Wise to conclude that W.E.D. feels himself deputized to cultivate American liberalism in Germany. He quoted Dodd's last remark, it will be pretty serious if I fail, serious for liberalism and all the things for which the president stands, for which I too stand. By this point, indeed, Dodd had come to envision his ambassadorial role as more than that of mere observer and reporter. He believed that through reason and example he ought to be able to exercise a moderating influence over Hitler and his government, and at the same time help nudge America from its isolationist course toward more international engagement. The best approach, he believed, was to be as sympathetic and non-judgmental as possible and try to understand Germany's perception that it had been wronged by the world. To an extent, Dodd agreed. In his diary, he wrote that the Treaty of Versailles, so loathed by Hitler, was unfair at many points, like all treaties which end wars. His daughter Martha, in a memoir, put it more strongly, stating that Dodd had deplored the treaty. Ever a student of history, Dodd had come to believe in the inherent rationality of men, and that reason and persuasion would prevail, particularly with regard to halting Nazi persecution of Jews. He told a friend, Assistant Secretary of State R. Walton Moore, that he would rather resign than simply to remain a protocol and social figurehead. The Dodds reached Germany on Thursday, July 13, 1933. Dodd had assumed erroneously that all arrangements for the family's arrival were in place, but after a slow and tedious passage up the Elbe, they disembarked in Hamburg to find that no one from the embassy had booked a train, let alone the customary private rail car to take them to Berlin. An official, George Gordon, counselor of embassy, met them at the dock and hastily secured compartments on an old conventional train, a far cry from the famous Flying Hamburger, which made the run to Berlin in just over 2 hours. The family Chevrolet posed another problem. Bill Jr. had planned to drive it to Berlin, but had failed to fill out the advance paperwork needed to get it off the ship and onto Germany's roads. Once this was resolved, Bill set off. Meanwhile, Dodd fielded questions from a group of reporters that included a writer for a Jewish newspaper, the Hamburger Israelitisches Familienblatt, which subsequently published an article implying that Dodd's primary mission was to stop Nazi persecution of Jews, exactly the kind of distortion Dodd had hoped to avoid. As the afternoon progressed, the Dodds developed a dislike for Counselor Gordon. He was second in command of the embassy and oversaw a cadre of first and second secretaries, stenographers, file and code clerks, and assorted other employees, about 24 in all. He was stiff and arrogant and dressed like an aristocrat from the prior century. He carried a walking stick. His mustache was curled, his complexion ruddy and inflamed, a marker of what one official called his very choleric temperament. He spoke in a manner that Martha described as clipped, polite, and definitely condescending. He made no attempt to hide his disdain for the family's simple appearance, or his displeasure at the fact that they arrived alone, without a battalion of valets, maids, and chauffeurs. The previous ambassador, Sackett, had been much more of Gordon's kind of man, rich, with 10 servants at his Berlin residence. Martha sensed that to Gordon her family represented a class of human being, the like of which he had not permitted himself to mingle with for perhaps most of his adult life. Martha and her mother rode in one compartment among bouquets of flowers given to them in welcome at the dock. Mrs. Dodd, Mattie, was uneasy and downhearted, anticipating the duties and change in life patterns that lay ahead, Martha recalled. Martha rested her head on her mother's shoulder and soon fell asleep. Dodd and Gordon sat together in a separate compartment, discussing embassy matters and German politics. Gordon warned Dodd that his frugality and his resolve to live only within his State Department income would prove a barrier to establishing a relationship with Hitler's government. Dodd was no longer a mere professor, Gordon reminded him. He was an important diplomat, up against an arrogant regime that respected only strength. Dodd's approach to daily life would have to change. The train raced through pretty towns and forested glens bladed with afternoon light, and in about 3 hours reached Greater Berlin. At last it steamed into Berlin's Lehrter Bahnhof, at a bend in the Spree where the river flowed through the heart of the city. One of Berlin's 5 major rail portals, the station rose above its surroundings like a cathedral, with a barrel-vaulted ceiling and banks of arched windows. On the platform the Dodds encountered a crowd of Americans and Germans waiting to meet them, including officials from the German Foreign Office and reporters armed with cameras and flash apparatus, known then as flashlights. An energetic-seeming man, mid-sized, about 5 feet 6 inches tall, a dry, drawling, peppery man, as historian and diplomat George Kennan later described him, stepped forward and introduced himself. This was George Messerschmitt, Consul General, the Foreign Service officer whose lengthy dispatches Dodd had read while in Washington. Martha and her father liked him immediately, judging him to be a man of principle and candor and a likely friend, though this appraisal was destined for significant revision. Messerschmitt returned this initial goodwill. "I liked Dodd from the outset," Messerschmitt wrote. "He was a very simple man in his manner and in his approach." He noted, however, that Dodd gave the impression of being rather fragile. In the crowd of greeters, the Dodds also encountered 2 women who, over the next several years, would play important roles in the family's life. One a German, the other an American from Wisconsin who was married to a member of one of Germany's loftiest scholarly dynasties. The German woman was Bella Fromm, Auntie Voss, society columnist for a highly respected newspaper, the Vossische Zeitung, one of 200 newspapers then still operating in Berlin and, unlike most of them, still capable of independent reportage. Fromm was full-figured and handsome, with striking eyes, onyx under black gull-wing brows, her pupils partially curtained by upper lids in a manner that conveyed both intellect and skepticism. She was trusted by virtually all members of the city's diplomatic community, as well as by senior members of the Nazi Party, no small achievement, considering that she was Jewish. She claimed to have a source high in Hitler's government, who gave her advance warning of future Reich actions. She was a close friend of Messerschmitt's. Her daughter Gani called him Uncle. Fromm, in her diary, recorded her initial observations of the Dodds. Martha, she wrote, seemed a perfect example of the intelligent young American female. As for the ambassador, he looks like a scholar. His dry humor attracted me. He is observant and precise. He learned to love Germany when he was a student in Leipzig, he said, and will dedicate his strength to build a sincere friendship between his country and Germany. She added, "I hope he and the President of the United States will not be too disappointed in their efforts." The second woman, the American, was Mildred Fish Harnack, a representative of the American Women's Club in Berlin. She was Fromm's physical opposite in every way— slender, blonde, ethereal, reserved. Martha and Mildred liked each other at once. Mildred wrote later that Martha is clear and capable and has a real desire to understand the world. Therefore, our interests touch. She sensed that she had found a soulmate, a woman who was seriously interested in writing. It's a hindrance to be lonely and isolated in one's work. Ideas stimulate ideas, and the love of writing is contagious. Martha, in turn, was impressed by Mildred. "I was drawn to her immediately," she wrote. Mildred exhibited an appealing combination of strength and delicacy. She was slow to speak and express opinions. She listened quietly, her large gray-blue eyes serious, weighing, evaluating, trying to understand. Counselor Gordon placed Martha in a car with a young protocol secretary assigned to accompany her to the hotel where the Dodds were to live until they could find a suitable house to lease. Her parents traveled separately with Gordon, Messersmith, and Messersmith's wife. Martha's car proceeded south over the Spray into the city. She found long, straight boulevards that evoked the rigid grid of Chicago, but the similarity ended there. Unlike the skyscraper-forested landscape she had walked through every workday in Chicago, here most buildings were rather short, typically 5 stories or so, and these amplified the low, flat feel of the city. Most looked to be very old, but a few were jarringly new, with walls of glass, flat roofs, and curved facades, the offspring of Walter Gropius, Bruno Taut, and Erich Mendelssohn, all condemned by the Nazis as decadent, communist, and inevitably Jewish. The city was full of color and energy. There were double-decked omnibuses, S-Bahn trains, and brightly colored trams whose catenaries fired off brilliant blue sparks. Low-slung automobiles thrummed past, most painted black, but others red, cream, and deep blue, many of unfamiliar design. The adorable Opel 416 PS, the Horch with its lethal arrow and bow hood ornament, and the ubiquitous Mercedes, black, low, edged with chrome. Joseph Goebbels himself was moved to capture in prose the energy of the city as exhibited in one of its most popular shopping avenues, the Kurfürstendamm, albeit in an essay meant not to praise but to condemn, calling the street the abscess of the city. The bells on the streetcars ring, buses clatter by honking their horns, stuffed full with people and more people. Taxis and fancy private automobiles hum over the glassy asphalt, he wrote. The fragrance of heavy perfume floats by. Harlots smile from the artful pastels of fashionable women's faces. So-called men stroll to and fro, monocles glinting. Fake and precious stones sparkle. Berlin was, he wrote, a stone desert filled with sin and corruption, and inhabited by a populace born to the grave with a smile. The young protocol officer pointed out various landmarks. Martha asked question after question, oblivious to the fact that she was trying the officer's patience. Early in their drive, they came to an open plaza dominated by an immense building of Silesian sandstone, with 200-foot towers at each of its 4 corners, built in what one of Carl Baedeker's famous guidebooks described as florid Italian Renaissance style. This was the Reichstagsgebäude, in which Germany's legislative body, the Reichstag, had convened until the building was set afire 4 months earlier. A young Dutchman, a lapsed communist named Marinus van der Lubbe, was arrested and charged with the arson, along with 4 other suspects named as accomplices. Although a widely endorsed rumor held that the Nazi regime itself had orchestrated the fire to stir fears of a Bolshevik uprising and thereby gain popular support for the suspension of civil liberties and the destruction of the Communist Party in Germany. The upcoming trial was the talk of Berlin. But Martha was perplexed. Contrary to what news reports had led her to expect, the building seemed intact. The towers still stood and the facades appeared unmarked. "Oh, I thought it was burned down," she exclaimed as the car passed the building. "It looks all right to me. Tell me what happened." After this and several other outbursts that Martha conceded were imprudent, the protocol officer leaned toward her and hissed, "Shh." Young lady, you must learn to be seen and not heard. You mustn't say so much and ask so many questions. This isn't America, and you can't say all the things you think." She stayed quiet for the rest of the drive. Upon reaching their hotel, the Esplanade, on the well-shaded and lovely Bellevue Strasse, Martha and her parents were shown the accommodations that Messerschmitt himself had arranged. Dodd was appalled, Martha enchanted. The hotel was one of Berlin's finest, with gigantic chandeliers and fireplaces, and two glass-roofed courtyards, one of which, the Palm Courtyard, was famous for its tea dances, and as the place where Berliners had gotten their first opportunity to dance the Charleston. Greta Garbo had once been a guest, as had Charlie Chaplin. Messerschmitt had booked the Imperial Suite, a collection of rooms that included a large double-bedded room with private bath, two single bedrooms also with private baths, one drawing room and one conference room, all arrayed along the even-numbered side of a hall, from room 116 through room 124. Two reception rooms had walls covered with satin brocade. The suite was suffused with a spring-like scent imparted by flowers sent by well-wishers, so many flowers, Martha recalled, that there was scarcely space to move in, orchids and rare-scented lilies, flowers of all colors and descriptions. Upon entering the suite, she wrote, "We gasped at its magnificence." But such opulence abraded every principle of the Jeffersonian ideal that Dodd had embraced throughout his life. Dodd had made it known before his arrival that he wanted modest quarters in a modest hotel, Messerschmitt wrote. While Messerschmitt understood Dodd's desire to live most inconspicuously and modestly, he also knew that the German officials and German people would not understand it. There was another factor. U.S. diplomats and State Department officials had always stayed at the Esplanade. To do otherwise would have constituted an egregious breach of protocol and tradition. The family settled in. Bill Jr. and the Chevrolet were not expected to arrive for a while yet. Dodd retired to a bedroom with a book. Martha found it all hard to grasp. Cards from well-wishers continued to arrive, accompanied by still more flowers. She and her mother sat in awe of the luxury around them, wondering desperately how all this was to be paid for without mortgaging our souls. Later that evening, the family rallied and went down to the hotel restaurant for dinner, where Dodd dusted off his decades-old German and in his dry manner tried to joke with the waiters. He was, Martha wrote, in magnificent humor. The waiters, more accustomed to the imperious behavior of world dignitaries and Nazi officials, were unsure how to respond and adopted a level of politeness that Martha found almost obsequious. The food was good, she judged, but heavy, classically German, and demanded an after-dinner walk. Outside, the Dodds turned left and walked along Bellevue Strasse, through the shadows of trees and the penumbrae of street lamps. The dim lighting evoked for Martha the somnolence of rural American towns very late at night. She saw no soldiers, no police. The night was soft and lovely. Everything, she wrote, was peaceful, romantic, strange, nostalgic. They continued on to the end of the street and crossed a small square into the Tiergarten, Berlin's equivalent of Central Park. The name, in literal translation, meant Animal Garden or Garden of the Beasts, which harked back to its deeper past when it was a hunting preserve for royalty. Now it was 630 acres of trees, walkways, riding paths, and statuary that spread west from the Brandenburg Gate to the wealthy residential and shopping district of Charlottenburg. The Spree ran along its northern boundary. The city's famous zoo stood at its southwest corner. At night, the park was especially alluring. In the Tiergarten, a British diplomat wrote, "The little lamps flicker among the little trees, and the grass is starred with the fireflies of a thousand cigarettes." The Dodds entered the Siegesallee, Avenue of Victory, lined with 96 statues and busts of past Prussian leaders, among them Frederick the Great, various lesser Fredericks, and such once-bright stars as Albert the Bear, Henry the Child, and Otto the Lazy. Berliners called them Puppen, dolls. Dodd held forth on the history of each, revealing the detailed knowledge of Germany he had acquired in Leipzig 3 decades earlier. Martha could tell that his sense of foreboding had dissipated. "I am sure this was one of the happiest evenings we spent in Germany," she wrote. "All of us were full of joy and peace." Her father had loved Germany ever since his tenure in Leipzig, when each day a young woman brought fresh violets for his room. Now, on this first night, as they walked along the Avenue of Victory, Martha, too, felt a rush of affection for the country. The city, the overall atmosphere, was nothing like what news reports back home had led her to expect. "I felt the press had badly maligned the country, and I wanted to proclaim the warmth and friendliness of the people, the soft summer night with its fragrance of trees and flowers, the serenity of the streets." This was July 13th, 1933. Part 2. House Hunting in the Third Reich. Chapter 6. Seduction. In her first few days in Berlin, Martha fell ill with a cold. As she lay convalescing at the Esplanade, she received a visitor, an American woman named Sigrid Schultz, who for the preceding 14 years had been a correspondent in Berlin for Martha's former employer, the Chicago Tribune, and was now its correspondent-in-chief for Central Europe. Schultz was 40 years old, 5'3", the same height as Martha, with blonde hair and blue eyes. A little pudgy, as Martha put it, with an abundance of golden hair. Despite her size and cherub's gleam, Schultz was known to fellow correspondents and Nazi officials alike as being tenacious, outspoken, and utterly fearless. She made every diplomat's invitation list and was a regular at parties thrown by Goebbels, Goering, and other Nazi leaders. Goering took a perverse delight in calling her the Dragon from Chicago. Schultz and Martha chatted at first about innocuous things, but soon the conversation turned to the rapid transformation of Berlin during the 6 months since Hitler had become chancellor. Schultz told stories of violence against Jews, communists, and anyone the Nazis saw as unsympathetic to their revolution. In some cases, the victims had been American citizens. Martha countered that Germany was in the midst of a historic rebirth. Those incidents that did occur surely were only inadvertent expressions of the wild enthusiasm that had gripped the country. In the few days since her arrival, Martha had seen nothing at all to corroborate Schultz's tales. But Schultz pressed on with stories of beatings and capricious imprisonments in the wild camps, ad hoc prisons that had sprung up throughout the country under the control of Nazi paramilitary forces, and in more formal prisons, known by now as concentration camps. The German word was Konzentrationslager, or KZ. The opening of one such camp had occurred on March 22, 1933, its existence revealed at a press conference held by a 32-year-old former chicken farmer turned commander of the Munich police, Heinrich Himmler. The camp occupied an old munitions factory, a brief train ride from Munich, just outside the charming village of Dachau, and now housed hundreds of prisoners, possibly thousands, no one knew, most arrested not on specific charges, but rather for protective custody. These were not Jews, not yet, but communists, and members of the liberal Social Democratic Party, all held in conditions of strict discipline. Martha grew annoyed at Schultz's effort to tarnish her rosy view, but she liked Schultz and saw that she would make a valuable friend, given her vast range of contacts among journalists and diplomats. They parted amicably, but with Martha unshaken in her view that the revolution unfolding around her was a heroic episode that could yield a new and healthy Germany. "I didn't believe all her stories," Martha wrote later. "I thought she was exaggerating, and a bit hysterical." When Martha left her hotel, she witnessed no violence, saw no one cowering in fear, felt no oppression. The city was a delight. What Goebbels condemned, she adored. A short walk from the hotel to the right, away from the cool green of the Tiergarten, took her to Potsdamer Platz, one of the busiest intersections in the world, with its famous five-way streetlight, believed to have been the first-ever stoplight installed in Europe. Berlin had only 120,000 cars, but at any given moment all of them seemed to collect here, like bees to a hive. One could watch the whirl of cars and people from an outdoor table at the Josti Café. Here, too, stood Haus Vaterland, a five-story nightclub capable of serving 6,000 diners in 12 restaurant milieus, including a Wild West bar with waiters in immense cowboy hats, and the Rhineland Wine Terrace, where each hour guests experienced a brief indoor thunderstorm, complete with lightning, thunder, and to the chagrin of women wearing true silk, a sprinkling of rain. What a youthful, carefree, won't-go-home-till-morning, romantic, wonderful place, one visitor wrote. It is the jolliest place in Berlin. For a 24-year-old woman, unencumbered by job and financial concern, and soon to be freed of a dead marriage, Berlin was endlessly compelling. Within days, she found herself going on an afternoon tea date with a famous American correspondent, H.R. Knickerbocker, Nick, to his friends, who filed stories for the New York Evening Post. He took her to the Eden Hotel, the notorious Eden, where communist firebrand Rosa Luxemburg had been beaten nearly to death in 1919, before being driven into the adjacent Tiergarten and killed. Now in the Eden's tea room, Martha and Nick danced. He was skinny and short, with red hair and brown eyes, and led her across the floor with skill and grace. Inevitably, the conversation shifted to Germany. Like Sigrid Schultz, Knickerbocker tried to teach Martha a bit about the politics of the country and the character of its new leadership. Martha wasn't interested, and the conversation drifted elsewhere. What enthralled her were the German men and women around her. She loved their funny, stiff dancing, listening to their incomprehensible and guttural tongue, and watching their simple gestures, natural behavior, and childlike eagerness for life. She liked the Germans she had met thus far, more certainly than the French she had encountered during her studies in Paris. Unlike the French, she wrote, the Germans weren't thieves, they weren't selfish, they weren't impatient or cold and hard. Martha's cheery view of things was widely shared by outsiders visiting Germany, and especially Berlin. The fact was that on most days in most neighborhoods the city looked and functioned as it always had. The cigar peddler in front of the Hotel Adlon at Unter den Linden Ein continued to sell cigars, as always, and Hitler continued to shun the hotel, preferring instead the nearby Kaiserhof. Every morning Germans crowded the Tiergarten, many on horseback, as thousands of others commuted into the city center on trains and trams from such neighborhoods as Wedding and Onkel Tom Sutte. Nicely dressed men and women sat in the Romanisches Café, drinking coffee and wine, and smoking cigarettes and cigars, and exercising the sharp wit for which Berliners were famed. The Berliner Schnauze, or Berlin Snout. At the Catacomb Cabaret, Werner Fink continued poking fun at the new regime, despite the risk of arrest. During one show, a member of the audience called him a lousy Yid, to which he responded, "I'm not Jewish. I only look intelligent." The audience laughed with gusto. Nice days were still nice. The sun shines, wrote Christopher Isherwood in his Berlin Stories, and Hitler is the master of this city. The sun shines, and dozens of my friends are in prison, possibly dead. The prevailing normalcy was seductive. I catch sight of my face in the mirror of a shop, and am shocked to see that I am smiling, Isherwood wrote. You can't help smiling in such beautiful weather. The trams moved as usual, as did the pedestrians passing on the street. Everything around him had an air of curious familiarity, of striking resemblance to something one remembers as normal and pleasant in the past. Like a very good photograph. Beneath the surface, however, Germany had undergone a rapid and sweeping revolution that reached deep.